Hello, everybody. So my talk will be indeed about the possible relations between problems in quantum field theory and the theory of topological model of forms. The great majority of the talk will consist of questions and problems I would like to see solved by somebody, well, probably a mathematician. At the very end, I might be able to discuss briefly some work I did in collaboration with Theo and with Ed Witten on the topic. So the main point when discussing quantum field theory is that quantum field theory is tough. Doing calculations is hard, understanding the dynamics is hard. We don't know as much about quantum field theory as we would like. There are a lot of physical challenges in understanding quantum field theory, as well as mathematical difficulties too. Now, because the dynamics is so hard, and because we know so little about quantum field theory, it's very good to find quantities which do not depend much on the dynamics. Questions, properties of a quantum field theory, which we can determine without having to solve the quantum field theory itself. Now, dynamics is very close to deformation when you talk about quantum field theories, because essentially all quantum field theories we know are presented to us as a deformation. Well, not all of them, but a lot of them at least are presented to us as a deformation of some simpler quantum field theory, like free quantum field theories. Also, the very basic dynamical question about quantum field theory the most basic dynamical questions about quantum field theory are encoded in the RG flow, the renormalization group flow, which is essentially the action of the scaling transformations in space-time on a quantum field theory. And changing the scale of space-time is a deformation of the theory. So the RG flow essentially gives you a family of quantum field, a one-parameter family of quantum field theories, which starts from a place you usually understand and ends somewhere you would like to find. So because of that, it's interesting to ask to find properties of quantum field theories which are invariants under deformation. If you find any property of a quantum field theory which is invariant under deformations of the quantum field theory, then it automatically gives you an invariant under RG flows. It automatically gives you a way to constrain the dynamics of the theory. The most typical such invariant are anomalies, where your quantum field theory has some symmetry, but actually, let me see. Right, so let me say even easier. The one possible anomaly was that you have a family of quantum field theories parametrized by some parameter that lives in some space, and you would like to make that space, that parameter, dynamical. You might not be able to do so. Another possibility is that you have a symmetry and you would like to couple your theory to a gauge connection for that symmetry. And again, that might not be possible. And the failure of being possible, the obstructions to being able to do these sort of things, are often the formation invariants of the theory. They're called Tufte anomalies. But in general, of course, the most refined deformation invariant of a theory is just the space of connected components in the space of theories. So if you have a way to label the connected components in the space of theories and to tell me in which component does a certain theory live, well, that will give you as much, essentially all the deformation invariants of your class of theories. So we really want to understand the homotopy of the space of quantum field theories, or more generally, the space of physical systems with some given properties. Now, in order to even talk about deformation, though, I need to specify what it means for two theories to be close to each other. I need to give some sort of a topology to the space of theories. And this will be done in a way that depends a bit on which kind of theories I'm studying. So I will always include things like changing the couplings of the theory, easy deformations, you know, if your theory depends on some continuous parameters and I vary them, that's obviously the deformation, as long as I preserve whatever properties I wanted to preserve. The Argif law, as I was saying, I want to be a deformation for sure. But typically, I will also allow sort of adding or removing degrees of freedom which are sufficiently trivial. Well, what that means specifically, as I say, depends on which types of theories I'm looking at. So this is sort of the general class of problems. I'm given a class of theories. I'm told that some of these theories are trivial and I can add them or remove them for free. And I'm told that I can change my couplings freely. What's the space of connected components of this beast? Is a typical problem which emerges in a lot of situations in modern theoretical physics. Now, today, in the context of elliptic cohomology, the type of systems I'm looking at are two-dimensional quantum field theories endowed with the smallest possible amount of supersymmetry, which is usually called 0.1 in physics. So it's really the smallest amount of supersymmetry you can have, where you have one odd symmetry generator which squares to an holomorphic combination, anti-holomorphic combination with translations in the two directions in 2D. Now, I want to study the space of deformations of two-dimensional quantum field theories with supersymmetry. And the kind of deformations I'm going to allow include adding or removing certain massive degrees of freedom. More specifically, I'm allowed to add degrees of freedom which have a unique supersymmetric vacuum and are massive. And I'm also allowed to add or remove superselection sectors which spontaneously break supersymmetry. Now, to help you understand, to be a bit more specific, let me remind you of a couple of facts about quantum field theories. So there are two elementary operations you can do when you're given two quantum field theories. You can add them or you can multiply them. So the product of two quantum field theories is a notion, is actually the simplest of the two notions. But in either cases, one way you can think about it is that when I add or multiply two theories, I add and multiply or multiply the Hilbert spaces, and I add or multiply their operator algebras. So physically, to multiply two theories together, I just take the degrees of freedom or the fields that describe one theory, I take the fields that describe the other theory, and I put them both in space-time without coupling them in any way. So I just take the degrees of freedom of the first theory and the degrees of freedom of the second theory, living without interacting with each other. And so if I'm a spectator living in the space-time, I can see particles of one type passing by or particles of the other type passing by, and they don't interact. And then once I take the product of two theories, I can start deforming it by turning on interactions to define a notion of a product of two deformation classes of theories. And for various reasons, I want to treat this as a quantum field theory with a single massive vacuum which preserves supersymmetry as a unit in this product. So I want to feel free of inverting it, adding it, removing, multiplying with it, or dividing by it. Adding two theories is a little bit more subtle because I'm adding the Hilbert spaces instead of multiplying them. Essentially, it's a situation where I have super selection sectors. The whole system is either in one theory or in the other, but not both. So if I'm an observer in that universe, I either see one type of particle going around or I see the other types of particles going around, but I never see both. And in this context, a theory, a supersymmetric theory which breaks supersymmetry can be considered a zero. So when I add deformation classes of theories, I will treat the deformation class of supersymmetry breaking theories as a zero, as the trivial theory. Any questions? Most of this was probably somewhat incomprehensible to mathematicians, but I hope it at least gives an impression of the fact that there is a physically reasonably well-defined notion of a deformation class of theories, of a space of quantum field theory, supersymmetric quantum field theories. And if you can axiomatize quantum field theories in a rigorous way, then you should be able to also axiomatize this notion.
So, if you add theories, can you couple them? Can you couple them?
That's a bit more subtle. You cannot, because you don't have operators which talked about. But it's often the case that if you have a family of theories, at the end of the family, you land on a direct sum. Because now all physical processes which allow you to move from one theory to the other, from one vacuum to the other, have been pushed away.
If I define a field theory as a monoidal functor from a Bordism N category into some monoidal N category,
mm-hmm.
that theories?
So that's just the direct sum to the sum of theories.
You have to be careful because direct sum of monoidal functors is not monoidal.
Exactly. I mean, how are you going to, you can really add functors like that? It's not obvious to me.
So you can only do this if they're fully extended functors.
But you're saying
you can do this if you have a fully extended theory, then you can add their values in a disk. But then you have to repatch that back to the whole thing. This is Greg that's talking, right?
Yes, I guess.
Yeah, this is Greg. Sorry.
Like, for example, essentially, this is just the notion of having true vacuum. For example, in a topological field theory, you look at the ring of local operators. It has a non-trivial spectrum. Each point in the spectrum will give you a different vacuum of the theory. And the whole theory can be thought of as a direct sum of many simpler theories. So when you study RG flows, it's relatively common to land on a theory which has multiple massive vacua, which can only talk to each other by some domain walls with some tension. And if you go to the far infrared, the tension goes to infinity, and then there is no physical process that can move you from one vacuum to the other. I don't know what's a good example, but right, if you study an Ising model where there is some field which is value in the reals, and at low energy this field wants to have value 1 or minus 1, say, then at very low energy, you're either sitting in a place where the field has value 1 or in a place where the field has value minus 1. And there are no processes at low energy which can move. We can change the situation. So often a quantum field theory flows to a direct sum of theories. Okay. Any more questions? Okay. So now, why do we think that this is an interesting problem? Why do we think that there are multiple connected components in this space? It's not obvious at all. If you're asking the same question without supersymmetry, we will be reasonably confident that the space of quantum field theories will be connected, and probably also simply connected to all orders. But in the case of supersymmetric quantum field theories, Witten introduced something called the elliptic genus, which is the torus partition function that you can bring when you pick an odd spin structure on the torus. And it demonstrated that this is a deformation invariant. The Leakey genus depends holomorphic on the complex structure of the torus and is independent of the area. And it gives you basically a modular form up to some multiplying by some powers of eta to get rid of some phases. So you get a map from quantum field theories, supersymmetric quantum field theories, to modular forms with a weight that depends on the anomaly of a certain gravitational anomaly of the original theory. And this map is a deformation invariant. And furthermore, it's very easy to produce quantum field theories which have non-trivial values to this Lipschitz genus. And so this gives you an immediate evidence that the space of quantum field theory must, in supersymmetric quantum field theories in two dimensions, must have a lot of interesting connected components. And then, of course, the question is, can you enrich, can you refine this invariant further? Is there, you know, is it possible that there is, that a theory which has, okay, let me say something. So if you have a theory that was had a single massive vacuum, the one I was considering as one, has an Lipschitz genus which is indeed one. If you have a theory that breaks supersymmetry, that I was considering as a zero in the deformation, it has indeed a Lipschitz genus zero. Now, the most basic question you could ask is, if I'm given a theory which has a Lipschitz genus zero, can I deform it to the to a supersymmetric breaking theory? These sort of questions are conjecturally answered by the mathematical technology of topological modular forms. So it's possible to argue that the space of supersymmetric quantum field theories is a spectrum in the mathematical sense, in the more homotopy meaning of the term. And there is a conjecture that this spectrum coincides with a mathematically well-defined spectrum called the topological modular forms. Or at the very least, the topological modular forms give you information about quantum field theories, which is more refined than the Lipschitz genus. That would be a weaker conjecture. But in particular, independent of which conjecture you believe, if this, if any of this is true, it means that for any quantum field, supersymmetric quantum field theory T, there should be a topological modular form T, you know, the class of T, which is a deformation invariant. And so the very first question I would like to ask is, how do I find this class? You know, suppose I know everything about a quantum field theory. And somebody, I'm in omnipotent, I have a full solution of the quantum field theory. I know the Hilbert space, I know all the operators, I know everything. How do I compute the TMF class of the theory? I would love to have a concise, clear answer to this question. If the quantum field theory is a sigma model, which is a weakly coupled theory, which describes map from 2D into a manifold, which has to be to have a string structure. Then, as far as I understand, there is a TMF class you can attach to the manifold, and that's supposed to be the image of the sigma model under this map from quantum field theories to topological modular forms. But I have no, and there are some small variations of this idea where you put an extra bundle of fermions on the manifold or something like that. But there are a lot of ways to produce a weakly coupled quantum field theory besides sigma models. But I have no idea what to do with those quantum field theories to get a TMF class. And on top of that, we have also a lot of ways to produce quantum field theories and solve even quantum field theories, which are really strongly coupled. For example, we can look at rational conformal field theories. These are theories which are completely solved algebraically. I would like to know which TMF classes correspond to rational conformal field theories. So there are sort of very basic questions I'd like to understand. And I'm not sure, they're not really. Some of these questions should be mathematically answerable, right? In the sense that if you assume that you know, as I was saying, the Hilbert space of the theory in a circle, and I don't know what else, you should have a way to produce the topological model of form associated with it. So this is my first wish. I wish somebody would tell me how to compute the TMF class of quantum field theory. Any questions or better any answers?
Yeah, I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Sorry, this is Neetu. And I'm backlit, so you can't see me. Why do you want to consider all field theories? Why not just focus on rational field theories? I mean, surely the interesting stuff you want is rational field theories, and then the deformation issue doesn't come up, right? I mean, you can't ask to move from one rational theory continuously into another, right?
I'd be happy to accept that rational conformal field theories are exactly as far as possible from the quantum field theories for which TMF has been developed. Yes?
So you're saying that the theories that there are mathematical constructions for are non-rational? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the sigma models, completely non-rational. They're not conformal either.
Interesting.
Although they float to conformal field theories, if you're lucky.
So what if things like WZW models, they're surely rational.
No clue. I have a clue for some of them because with you and Edward, we worked out some, you can find situations where you have a sigma model which flows to the WZW model. And then you can guess that they have the same TMF class. But that's not the same as computing the TMF class of WZW, which should be doable.
Thank you. I'll ask you more.
Was there another question?
When you say SQFT is a spectrum, do you have a physical reason for these maps from the space of conformal field, space of quantum field theories at some conformal anomaly to the loop space of the space of
TU has given me several arguments to have the correct name of the spectrum. Right? It's an orthogonal spectrum.
I think I can hand you. Well, I can't do it completely. I can, but yeah, I think we've sketched in various things with Davide why it should be an omega spectrum. And I think I can even kind of hand you an E infinity orthogonal omega spectrum structure.
Okay, I'd be happy just to understand the omega spectrum, but now. Maybe I'll just...
The basic idea is that whenever you have a path of theory, a one parameter family of theories, you can promote the parameter to a field. That gives you a theory which has a slightly different gravitational anomaly, because when you make this parameter into a field, you also need to add a fermion as a super partner.
I see, gotcha. Okay, awesome, thanks.
That's pretty much it. And conversely, and you can adjust things so that this promotion has an inverse.
So the Scholz-Steigner conjecture, as I understand it, was phrased for specifically thinking about the world sheet as a porous. And here you're not making any such restriction. You're just saying consider 2D 0,1 theories.
Quantum field theories are a local notion.
Yeah, absolutely. So what happens if you consider, say, free bosons on a torus, supersymmetric free bosons on a torus, say like the EA plus E8 and the E16 toroid, the two even unimodular lattices of rank 16. Mm-hmm. Do those guys have different twisted partition functions at higher genus?
Yeah, that was my next page, yes.
Okay, awesome, thanks.
That's right, so you're perfectly correct. I take any holomorphic, actually spin holomorphic vertex algebra. So it's a vertex algebra which might have spin 1/2 fields, but has a category of modules which has a unique, which is trivial. And I can just say, okay, it's supersymmetric in a stupid way. It's purely holomorphic, right? Moving translate, anti-holomorphic translations act trivially, and so I can take the supersymmetry to also act trivially. The elliptic genus of this supersymmetric theory is just the vacuum character of the vertex algebra. You get the negative weight once you multiply by the powers of beta, divide. And I have no clue if different VOAs with the same central charge give you the same or different TMF classes. But there should be a TMF class attached to any holomorphic spin VOA. So yes, I take the 22 Niemeyer lattices in which is equal to 24 theory. Are they all the same TMF class? Are they different TMF classes? I have no clue. And actually, you don't even need to use even self-dual lattices because you're perfectly happy with odd self-dual lattices too. So that's a perfectly reasonable question. If I have a supersymmetric vertex algebra, I can conjugate it to an anti-chiral theory. Well, now the supersymmetry is acting in a non-trivial way by the super-Virasoro generator. And now the Lipschitz genus is an integer. It counts the number of Ramon vacua. After you convert it to the modular form, it gives you some power eta function times the integer. And again, it's a TMF class. Which TMF class? I don't know. Do I get a lot of vertex algebras for the same TMF class? Do I get one for each class? Do I have classes which have no vertex algebras? I don't know. I mean, with TU again, we did some very, very rough calculations to try to produce some candidates for some classes, which kind of seem to behave right in the correct way, but I don't know what the story is. Any questions?
So David, in this example, the first kind of example, your Niemeyer lattices or your EA cross EA and spin 32 months E2.
Yes.
Of course, we can connect these theories continuously through Norain compactifications, but the point is that wouldn't preserve 0-1 supersymmetry? Or?
Well, you could do a supersymmetric Norain compactification, but essentially what you're doing is taking these theories, multiplying them by a supersymmetric circle, and then deforming. Now, there are two supersymmetric circles, right? One of them is trivial in TMF, correct me if I'm wrong. And the other is
right. One of them is bounding, and the
you
other.
Certainly,
is...
you can in the old language you can compactify on a circle and then continuously connect, say, spin 32 mod z2 to ea cross ea.
But so right, you need to take those theories and multi-tensor them with the theory of a circle.
Okay, that's true.
And the theory has, depending on the spin structure you pick on the circle, it either has is zero in TMF. Or is zero mod shu? I mean, it's one mod shu. So you're presumably losing information when you do that. Right. And there are also sort of interesting questions that arise when you start looking at these problems, like building supersymmetric VOAs which have the correct, just the correct number of vacua that you want. Because an integer times the power of eta might not be a TMF class if the integer is wrong. And so presumably that means that you don't have a theory with that number of Ramon vacua, which is a fun statement. Which again, we probed a little bit in some paper with in a paper with Theo. Right, and you know, even worse, you know, not just holomorphic, even rational quantum field theories, if you want to be able to do calculations. And I'll say more about it momentarily. So right, I anticipated some of these questions. What's the recipe to compute the class of a theory? Which data does it need? Do you need everything about the theory? Do you need this Hilbert space as a function of the radius of the circle and perhaps the action of the Elgin or the stress tensor on it? I don't know. Notice there are torsion classes in TMF, meaning there are precisely objects which are very close to be zero, but they're not zero unless you take multiple copies of them. So you get to a situation where the direct sum of null trivial theories may be trivial, which puts a lot of constraints of which sort of physical techniques you use to study this problem. Now you need to be able to have deformation invariants, which can really distinguish direct sums of theories. So physical calculation can produce torsion classes.
Maybe a comment. So in the supersymmetric quantum mechanics, you can produce these torsion classes from looking at the Z2 index of the Dirac operator. So it might be similar mechanisms in this context.
That's right. But then there are Z24 classes.
Absolutely.
So that gets more interesting. And there is the famous periodicity by 576, which must have a physical interpretation, but I don't know what it is.
But does this mean that there's a mod 24 index of the Dirac operator on loop space?
It's not any. So we found some ways to compute some of these torsion classes physically, and I'll discuss it at the very end, but they were not quite indices of Dirac operators. I'm stressing, a lot of the properties of TMF are just not immediately transparent in physics at all. I will discuss some more at the end, but for now, let me just switch gears slightly and present other wishes. So quantum field theories can have symmetries, discrete or continuous ones. And it's very natural to look at the formation classes of quantum field theories, which preserve some symmetry. As I was mentioning, one important deformation invariant is the anomaly of this symmetry, which is naively classified by the third group cohomology of the group. Sorry, there was supposed to be a three there. I don't know whether it's a four. The third group cohomology of the group, valuing U1. But more precisely by something called super cohomology, which I'm not going to discuss. But anyway, you should be able to say to us what the spectrum of quantum, supersymmetric quantum field theories with a given symmetry and a given anomaly. Now, I understand that over the last year or so, there has been proposed, the notion of equivariant EMF has been developed in a mathematically rigorous way. So I would love to see some matches between expectations I have on the physical side and properties of equivariant EMF. And before I discuss some of these matches, I would point out that rational conformal field theories often have very large symmetries. So all these questions I was asking about the TMF image of rational conformal field theories have all sorts of fun variants when you study equivariant EMF. For example, the monster CFT should live somewhere in the monster equivariant topological model forms with a very specific anomaly. So if you're talking about sigma models with the geometric action of the symmetry group over your manifold, I think we can understand each other pretty well. I assume that if you have a manifold with a G action, you can get a class in equivalent EMF, as long as the G action preserves the string structure. And I would guess that's the image of the sigma model in TMF. But you should immediately notice that once you talk about symmetries, there are a lot of fun non-perturbative things that can happen even in sigma models. It's perfectly possible for sigma models to have symmetries which are not perturbative, which do not come from a geometric action on the manifold. When you think about mirror symmetry, you see plenty of examples. A simple way to produce an example is to think about theories which have a discrete, finite abelian symmetry group. Then there is an operation, if the symmetry is non-anomalous, there is an operation called orbifold, which takes the theory with G symmetry and spits out a new theory where G has been gauged. This new theory does not have the old symmetry, but it always gets an emergent new symmetry, which is the Poincaré dual of the group. This action is not geometric. If you had a sigma model and you orbifold, you get a sigma model on G mod M mod G, as far as I understand. M mod G does not have a G dual action, but the sigma model does. So I think I'll feel really relieved if somebody can tell me that a covariant TMF has an operation of gauging the symmetry, which produces TMF classes for the dual symmetry. Is this the case? So if I have a TMF class, which is Zichu equivariant, I should be able to gauge Zichu and get a new TMF class, which is again Zichu equivariant, if the Zichu was non-anomalous. Do you have any questions?
And if you gauge the dual G, then you should get back the original theory.
Absolutely, that's right.
So the point, I guess, is that you're saying that Z2 equivariant CMF should have two maps to non-equivariant CMF. Either you take the underlying sigma class or you gauge the Z2 and then take the class.
Yeah, but the second one should have a lift to equivariant TMF again. Equivariant under the dual group.
So you're saying that Z2 equivariant CMF should have two maps to TMF, the two I described, and there should be a automorphism of Z2 equivariant CMF that exchanges them.
That's right. And this is completely non-geometric. But I know that mirror symmetry, T-duality is a thing that is being studied by, we saw some T-duality in the talk this morning, so I assume that some of the two mathematical tools must be there already. Right, essentially what's happening is that if I have a circle with a Zichu action, for example, the circle becomes twice as short, but the T-dual circle becomes twice as long. And that's the new Zichu. So there's sort of a T-duality, a discrete T-duality. There should be a discrete T-duality in TMF. Now, there are even less perturbative things that you can consider. Indeed, these you stumble into them as soon as you try to orbifold non-abelian finite symmetries. If you have a theory which has G symmetry and you gauge G, assuming it was not anomalous, you get a new theory which does not have a G symmetry anymore, but it has a generalized symmetry. Generalized symmetries are controlled by fusion categories, and this T mod G has a generalized symmetry given by the fusion category representations of G. So in general, if you give me any spherical superfusion category F, you can talk about quantum field, supersymmetric quantum field theories with generalized symmetry F. And so there should be an F equivariant TMF. A TMF which is not group equivariant, but is full superfusion category equivariant. Is this a natural notion? Do you have any questions?
You haven't said the word modular category. Are you going
to? Not yet. Next slide. Next slide.
But I'll save my question.
That's right. And then you can get an even broader generalization when you start playing with these topological operations, where instead of thinking about two-dimensional absolute quantum field theories, you talk about two-dimensional relative quantum field theories, which are quantum field theories which live at the boundary of a topological field theory in three dimensions. So essentially, what does that mean is that the partition function of the theory is not a number anymore, but it's an element in the vector space, which is vector space that the three-dimensional topological field theory attaches to your manifold. It's perfectly possible to have a theory which is not topological, but lives at the boundary of a topological field theory. That, a Carroll WZLB model is an example. Carroll WZLB model is a non-topological theory which lives at the boundary of Chern-Simons theory and could not live on itself, on its own. Three-dimensional topological field theories are naively controlled by modular tensor categories, although because of an fermionic work here, you really need this sort of a super generalization of that, which again, I will not try to discuss. But the point is that now the elliptic genus, which is a partition function, is again, is not a function anymore. It's gonna be a vector valued modular form instead of the modular form. So if you have a two-dimensional theory which lives at the boundary of 3D TFT, the elliptic genus is vector valued modular forms that lives in a space which is the Hilbert space or the 3D TFT on the torus.
So here I have a question. Mm-hmm. Is there a notion, sort of a question for the whole audience, is there a notion of topological modular forms for congruent subgroups? In other words, they're not going to be SL2Z modular forms, but they'll be modular forms for congruent subgroups, because at least in RCFT, when you have these vector-valued partition functions, you can, it's basically the orbit of a partition function which is invariant under a congruent subgroup. You get the other ones by acting with the conjugacy classes.
Yes. Modular forms with level structure is a story.
Hmm?
The buzzwords are topological modular forms with level structure.
Mm-hmm. But somehow, it's more natural to really have vector value modular forms as a notion rather than trying to work with congruent subgroups.
But what I'm saying is that that's pretty much equivalent for RCFTs.
Is it?
Yeah.
I mean, I would think there are more modular tensor categories than congruent subgroups.
Well, let me just speak to RCFTs. So, it was actually worked out in some detail by Bente, if I remember correctly. You have to prove a few things about the. So, if you have a vector value, if you have a rational conformal field theory with where the characters form some vector valued modular form, then you get a representation of SL2Z, but it is indeed coming from a one-dimensional representation of a congruent subgroup.
But I could have two different modular tensor categories which give me the same subgroup, the same congruent subgroup, right? I mean, my character might be fixed by a bigger subgroup of SL choose Z than the congruent subgroup. So if I sort of look only at the congruent subgroup, I'm losing some information. In particular, I think an advantage of working in modular tensor categories is that you have modular functors. So interfaces between three-dimensional topological field theories give interesting relations physically, meaning that if I have a boundary condition for theory one and a topological interface to theory two, I can get a boundary condition for theory two. So this sort of modular tensor category TMF should be functorial. If you give me a modular functor, an interface between two three-dimensional topological field theories, I should be able to carry over the TMF class from one modular tensor category to the other. And this is particularly important when you try to work with rational conformal field theories. For example, suppose I want to study the TMF class of a non-chiral WCW model. Natural way would be to study the TMF class of the chiral WCW relative to Chern-Simons theory and the class of anti-chiral WCW relative to Chern-Simons theory, and then glue them along the topological, along the modular tensor category, essentially by using the canonical functor from C times C bar to the trivial category. So it seems to me that this is a very natural place to study rational conformal field theories. Because in particular, you can just, a chiral algebra by itself would live in this space, and an anti-chiral algebra would live itself in this space, and then you can start gluing.
So, Davide, can I ask you a related question to what you just said?
Mm-hmm.
So what if you turn the question around and ask, let's take all rational vertex algebras of a fixed central charge and invert, sort of up to Morita equivalence. So invert all the holomorphic ones and ask, what are you left with? So you fix the central charge and you ask, you classify all rational vertex algebras of that central charge where you've inverted holomorphic vertex algebras. So sort of Morita equivalence classes. Mm-hmm. I mean, so you're sort of asking the question on the other side. You want to compare the object that I just described with TMF. Am I right? That's what you're trying to do.
I'm not sure I would invert it, but I'm not sure I would invert holomorphic theories, because holomorphic theories can have an unreal TMF class.
You want to invert delta, right? The discriminant eventually.
Do I?
Well, I mean, that in TMF, at least the smooth version of TMF.
But I want to invert I want to invert delta to the 24.
Yeah. Right. So maybe you don't want to invert the holomorphic ones, but there's some holomorphic theory you're going to invert.
Yeah, no, that's right. There must be one holomorphic theory, a central charge 188. Yes. Which presumably has a single Ramon vacuum or something like that. And
so, I mean, this ties to what Greg was saying. I presume Greg was the one asking these questions. I didn't see him, but I heard his voice. I mean, yeah. His original paper. What was it, you, Greg?
Yes. Anyway,
okay. Yeah. All right. But his original paper with Zeiberg, I mean, these are the kinds of questions he was asking in that original paper, if I remember correctly, just sort of classifying chiral algebras up to some sort of equivalence.
But that's more about the Witt group and things like that than about, I don't think I would use TMF to classify chiral algebras.
No, I was asking the other question.
It might be an important invariant. I have no idea. So I don't know if I have no idea really if two different vertex algebras with the same model tensor category can always be connected in TMF or not. I don't know. So it might be that TMF is a very rich vertex algebra invariant, but we have really no data.
Could you take your 3D bulk to not be topological? Like, say instead you just took it to be the 3D n equals 1 sigma model to some target M and try to classify 2D 0,1 preserving boundary conditions. Do you expect to get a model for TMF of M?
I think so. But you don't need, I don't think you need to ever make it dynamical.
Okay.
It's making it dynamical is dangerous because 3D sigma models are not normalizable. Right. So I would always feel a little uncomfortable about that.
Okay. The reason I ask is I like your comments on functoriality as coming from interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
Then for these non-dynamical 3D bulks, maybe you take a look at this restricted subclass of just sigma models, supersymmetric sigma models. If you have maps between manifolds, you would expect the corresponding maps on the phases of the boundary conditions to be those given by push forward and pull back in TMF. Is that a reasonable reading of what you're saying on the next slide in this restricted class?
Possibly, but right, for continuous manifolds, I get worries. If the 3D theory is topological, I'm fine. If the 3D theory is not topological, then dynamics might matter.
Okay.
We would have to study first questions about deformation classes of 3D theories before we can study deformation classes of the boundaries.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
And maybe all 3D theories are connected, in which case you wouldn't gain physically. I don't know. Okay, so all these are all I want to say for now for discrete symmetries. I should mention that there are also continuous symmetries can also play an important role. When you have continuous symmetries, the elliptic genus is promoted to essentially a Wing-Jacobi form, because now you can make it a function. The partition function is a function of the complex structure of the torus, but also the bundle for the for your group, say U1. An interesting point is that there are theories which are a bit sick as theories on their own, but they can be kind of regularized by turning on a G-bundle. The classical example would be a sigma model in Arch whose target is Arch2. That's a theory which says the partition function is infinite because the volume of Arch2 is infinite. But if you look equivalently with respect to U1, the partition function becomes something like eta cubed over theta. So it's a reasonable Jacobi form with a pole at z equal to zero. And when you compute elliptic general, this can be useful intermediate step. Sometimes, you know, for example, suppose I want to study the elliptic genus of CP1. There are ways to compute it by starting from C2 engaging U1. And so I wonder if these sort of sick theories can be made sense of it of in TMF to do, you know, for various applications. Okay, so I would like to, are there any questions?
So in the last slide, you were sort of inviting two things. You were inviting topological Jacobi forms, which maybe somebody yes. in the audience knows about. And you were inviting kind of meromorphic Jacobi
forms. That's right, meromorphic topological Jacobi forms. I mean, Arch2 is a very natural manifold. Sorry?
So I'm surprised at Theo's question already, because it means I must be misreading this. Just in the restricted class of sigma models, again, the original statement that we had this lifted TMF is the string orientation of Hendel-Hopkins-Bresk. And, you know, in the simple case that your continuous symmetry is U1, I would call this the U1 equivariant string orientation of Hendel-French and Cantor. And that's the story.
Okay, great.
Okay, well, cool.
I mean, I don't know. Is there a general story of topological Jacobi forms that it fits into?
Yeah, U1 equivariant topological modular. So I don't think that theory has been developed yet, except for the fact that we'll hear about it tomorrow morning or in whatever time zone you're in. So, you know, like to some extent, it's very recent, but yeah, like this doesn't seem like the sort of thing that's mathematically way out, you know, in left field or something.
And it says that, you know, part of the point is that free theories are typically sick in this stuff. No massive free theories, like a single model in nature. But turning on equivalence allows you to talk about them.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can gauge the U1 and get a theory which is not sick. So yeah,
The cool thing that you're mentioning seems to be this Bielanicki-Brewer type decomposition and suggesting that the equivariant elliptic genus decomposes as to that. And that is not a story that exists yet.
Okay, so I was thinking of devoting the last 10 minutes to or 5 minutes, how much time?
I think yeah, Ping's supposed to be in charge.
Oh, 5 minutes.
Okay. A couple slides on the work I did with you and Edward. I can perhaps describe it briefly. So, well, the beginning, I mean, part of the work was just to understand some physical examples, find some TMF classes for rational conformal field theories, and also verify that some basic properties of TMF do indeed hold for the theories. For example, TMF is invariant under homotopy of manifolds. But it's not quite clear that doing an homotopy to a manifold would be a nice deformation of a sigma model. You know, if I think of an homotopy about an evolution of a manifold that occasionally goes singular, I might worry about the sigma model going bad there. But we convinced ourselves that we can indeed, we could indeed prove that sigma models related by homotopy, with targets was related by an homotopy, were related by
homotopy here, do you mean cobordism?
Cobordism, yes, cobordism, sorry, homotopy, my bad, yes, it was supposed to be cobordism. So the fact that TMF is a cobordism invariant seems physically natural. Now, another thing we did was to use some knowledge about RG flows to start from nice sigma models and land on rational CFTs so that we could have some predictions for TMF classes of R CFTs. In particular, there is a nice RG flow that starts from a sigma model whose target space is a group, is a Lie group, like SU2, with a certain H flux to a certain string structure. And that flows to the WCW model, so symmetric WCW model for G. And so you learn the TMF classes of WCW models. And this gives you nice examples of torsion classes in TMF. So it was a useful step for the next projects. Which was to try to figure out a physical interpretation of torsion classes. So we wanted to find a physical proof that a 0.1 WCW model, this was supposed to be an SU2, not G. SU2 WCW model level K is physically non-trivial unless K is 0 modulo 24. So we wanted to find this mod 24 torsion class in physics. So we found a proof that uses the theory of Mock-Mozgov forms. So assume that you have some manifold which is a boundary, and give it a metric which is a cylindrical M. So a metric that asymptotically looks like M times R. Sorry, let's say better. Suppose I have an M which is a boundary, or some N with a cylindrical M. The sigma model on this non-compact manifold with boundary with cylindrical end is sick, is non-compact, and is a pretty bad type of non-compactness. It cannot even be saved by equivariance. So the elliptic genus in this non-compact manifold is not a model of forms. It's not holomorphic in particular. But we realized that there is an holomorphic anomaly equation which controls the lack of holomorphicity of this partition function for the sigma modulus target N. And that the source of this holomorphic anomaly equation has to do with the sigma model on the boundary. If you take this non-holomorphic thing and you send tau bar to infinity formally, you get something which is holomorphic but not modular. It's something which is called the Mock-Mozgov form. And we argue that this Mock-Mozgov form should have integrality properties. So now you can do the following exercise. You can find the source of this holomorphic anomaly equation for M and solve the holomorphic anomaly equation and then send tau bar to infinity. If what you find has integrality properties, then it's reasonable to expect that M is a boundary and it would be trivial physically too. But if you do this operation,
In your manifolds, I assume that M is a string manifold, but N is not necessarily equipped with a string structure?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, thank you.
Right, so essentially, if you solve this holomorphic anomaly equation, you find a solution which is a Mock-Mozgov form which has coefficients which are not integral, then that's evidence that there is no way to trivialize this theory in a physical setup. So anyway, sorry, I'm making a long story very short, but I'm just saying that by playing with this holomorphic anomaly equation, we managed to produce some torsion invariants with a physical interpretation. And we computed them for these SU2 WCW models. And we found that the Mock-Mozgov form started with K over 24, essentially, and then Laplace integers. And so this gave a physical way to understand at least some torsion classes in TMF. And I should say immediately that this is not general. So we can find torsion classes which are not seen by this technology. But at least it's a first step in trying to give a physical interpretation to TMF. But I don't even know if it's a good step, meaning that it's possible that somehow this was something magical that happened only for these particular classes, and the way to get torsion classes, physical intervention of torsion classes in general would be different. You know, as I said in the beginning, there should be just a recipe to get TMF classes from theories. And then from that recipe, we should learn what the correct physical interpretation of TMF classes is. This is just experimentation. Okay, and I told you all I wanted to say and asked all the questions I wanted to ask. Do you have any more questions?
If I consider the... Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah.
Supposing I have a string manifold and I look at its TMF and think about the torsion in that, is there any relation to the torsion in the K theory, or perhaps real K theory of that manifold? Is there something, any kind of spectral sequence or anything like that? Any homomorphism?
I assume that's not a question for me, right?
It was sort of a question for everybody here.
Greg, I think that
the reason I ask is that there is a physical interpretation of torsion classes in K theory.
Right. So a TMF class, or at least a quantum field theory, you do know how to write down a mod 2 index and read off the mod 2 index. And that's among the torsion in CMF, but it's a little fraction of the torsion in CMF.
No, I meant more than just the mod 2 index. I mean, what I have in mind is that there is a physical interpretation of torsion classes in K theory, thanks to string theory of D-brains. I was wondering if that could give a hint.
Presumably there's a character map to K-theory with a parameter, right? From TMF.
Yeah, I was thinking, I was hoping for an answer like that, right? Yeah.
But the torsion classes David is talking about are live in the CMF of a point. And the K-theory of a point only has the mod 2
okay.
Windows.
Okay, no. Then I was on the wrong track, sorry.
I would like to ask a question. So. From at the prime 2, the most effective calculation of TMF has to do with sort of thinking about the binary tetrahedral group and its cohomology, and there's a spectral sequence where you have that group acting on some modular stuff, and the cohomology of the binary tetrahedral group with those coefficients converges to TMF at the prime 2. So is there any source that you see the binary tetrahedral group playing sort of some role in the story you're telling us?
Do you have anything to say about the equivalent TMF and what you just said?
I don't know how to say that in equivariant terms.
Is there a lattice on which that group acts?
I think it can be thought of as looking at level 3 modular forms. They are much better. The moduli space of that is an actual moduli space as opposed to moduli stack. Mm-hmm. And then you have sort of the residual SL2F3 acting on it. I think that might be a way to put it.
Uh-huh. So does it have something to do with the torus with special symmetries or?
Yes, exactly. When you go to level 3 things, you don't have the extra symmetries that you would have if you look at the full modular group. And so that sort of removes the isotropy subgroups, and that makes the story, the coefficients of the level three modular forms, just a polynomial ring, which is very simple. And if you want to, all the torsion, at least at the prime two and TMF, is due to the non-freeness of this binary tetrahedral group action on the modular forms at level three.
Yeah, so I don't know what to say.
Okay, no, I was just curious whether there was some perspective on that from the physics side. Thank you.
So considering this map from phases of 2D 0,1 theories to TMF of a point, you discussed at length the extent to which you know this is surjective or not. Do you have a reading on whether this should be injective or not? Do you have an opinion either way?
Meaning that all TMF classes should come from...
No, yeah, the opposite. If you have two guys with the same TMF class, do you expect them to exist in the same connected component of 0,1 theories?
I really don't know. I mean, clearly the conjecture would be most beautiful if that was the case, but.
I see. So one of the things I was trying to ask was, I don't seem to have a particular example in mind, but I assumed that it would be possible to cook up 2D 0,1 theories. Let's say we're in a degree or a conformal anomaly or whatever you want to say, such that we have an actual modular form. Like we're not in one of the cases where TMF of a point is just torsion. I thought it would be possible to cook up two theories with the same elliptic genus, but different and higher genera. Different partition functions, odd spin structure, and higher genus surfaces.
But different partition function is not an obstruction to being related by deformation.
So I want not the partition function, but some kind of twisted partition function. I don't know if this is a thing that exists or is talked about in physics literature.
I mean, there's no reason for the deformation to preserve conformal invariance. And so the higher genus stuff is not a priori part of the deformation class.
Ah, okay, meant higher genus, yes, right. In QFT, there is nothing like a partition function in higher genus.
Let's see, okay.
You can define it, but it depends on the metric of the higher genus surface. There is no supersymmetry.
Oh, great. Okay, cool. So you could start
is that right? I thought that Issinger and
Alvarez
has defined a higher genus analog of the elliptic genus. I don't know any details, but I do remember they had some paper on that. It was Issinger and Orlando. I see Davide's point. So they had to do something, but I thought they wrote a paper about it was Issinger and Alvarez, if I remember correctly, and they were defining higher genus analogs of the elliptic genus. So they were thinking about trying to define some analog where you look at the probably conformal field theory on a higher genus surface.
It wasn't conformal field theory because they were the setting of sigma models to general manifolds again.
Oh, sorry. Maybe, you're right.
I think what they did was they considered, you know, in MG, the guy with constant curvature, and then took what they called some kind of semi-classical limit, which was probably either taking the volume really large or the volume really small. So there was definitely some trickery there that I haven't really understood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for quantum field theories in general, it would seem quite unnatural to move away from the torus.
Okay, yeah, great. Because then I could say, well, you know, take a Carlo, whatever, yeah, holomorphic field theory and then start playing these games again. But you would say, well, okay, fine, I could do that and I could come up with, by the tricks that you outlined in that slide, some 2D 0,1 model, but maybe the deformation classes won't preserve that structure. So, okay. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I should stress, we're allowing a very broad class of deformations. It's not just RG flow. It's really move along the RG flow, add degrees of freedom, move more, remove them. You can go quite far.